So good evening. My name is Stephen Gassner, and a little about myself. I've been practicing with this center since 1995, and I've been practicing Buddhist meditation since 1983 for a number of years in Los Angeles at the Zen Center of Los Angeles under Joko Beck and other teachers, and also with Shinzen Young of Community Meditation Center. The topic of my talk is wise and wholesome speech, sometimes called right speech. How I got interested in this practice, it was around 10 years ago, and I was with a colleague of mine who I work with who worked down south in Los Angeles. We went out to dinner with my wife, and I started talking about a colleague of ours, and it was actually gossip about the colleague, and my friend got quite annoyed with me, and started telling me how upset he was and about gossiping and how bad it is. And he started telling me in the Jewish tradition about the practice of not gossiping. And I was very distressed for what he told me for a number of reasons. First, I knew he was right. I shouldn't be gossiping. And second of all, I've been sitting for a number of years and I should know better. From that point on, I started really watching my speech and watching gossiping. And when him and I got together, we'd always be extremely mindful about not gossiping. In the last 8 months, I've got a new interest in right speech. Another one of my colleagues at work said, "Steve, you know, we're senior engineers here and we shouldn't talk like sailors and we really should clean up our language." And so I've been working with that. The topic of right speech is extremely important in Buddhism. It's one of the five precepts. For those who don't know what the precepts are, for lay people, there are five precepts. For monks, there are 238 precepts, and these are training precepts, and they're to help us in our practice. The five lay precepts are not to kill, not to steal, not to misuse your sexuality, not to lie, which is the right speech, and not to misuse intoxicants. It's also one of the parts of the Eightfold Path, which is the foundation of Buddhist practice on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. His realization was the Four Noble Truths, and to reiterate those here, the first noble truth is the truth of suffering in our experience. The second is the cause of suffering, which is craving. The third is that there's an end to craving. And the fourth is the path leading to the end of craving. Now, in the Eightfold Path, there's three aspects of the Eightfold Path. There's wisdom, morality, and meditation. And in the wisdom and the morality, there's three parts. And those are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right action composing the other four precepts, and right speech being the other one. So you can see the importance in Buddhism. But if you really look at it, it's a really important issue in our lives from day to day. Several years back, Sylvia Borstein, who's a teacher at Spirit Rock, came and gave a talk at this center. And she started the talk by saying, "How many people have broken a bone in their body through their life?" And then she said, "How many people who have broken it in the last year still feel the aches and pains of it?" And a number of people raised their hand and said, "In the last 5 years, how many people?" And there were less. And she went, by the time she got to 10, no one raised their hands. Then she asked, "How many people have been suffering because of what someone said to them in the last week?" And a lot of people raised their hands. And she said, in the last year, still a lot of people. And she got up to 20 years, and people were still raising their hands. Rabbi Telushkin is a rabbi who gives a lot of seminars on right speech, and one of the things he asks, how many people know in their family have relatives who are not speaking to each other because of things that they said, and a number of people raised their hands. There's also an interesting story about Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer who's very, very famous, wrote a number of books. In his autobiography, he says that when he was in high school, he wrote something and he went up in front of the class to read it, and he got a lot of verbal abuse from the teacher and put him down. And when he wrote his autobiography, he was like in his 70s, and he said it still affected him, even though he was a very famous man at that time. And we should all reflect on how many of us have said things that we've regretted to people. Now, as a mindfulness practice, for me, it's an extremely important practice. Many people wonder, we sit on the pillow, and how do we bring this into our daily lives? Our speech is one of the main ways we communicate with the world. It gives people our identity in the world, gives us our ideas, and also shows our negative side. So becoming mindful of that is really important to do. It's also an extremely difficult practice because in many of our mindfulness practices, sitting on the pillow, we just can sit back and observe. Or if we're doing mindfulness of walking or driving, there's input. But as we're speaking, we're doing something active, so it makes it that much more difficult. You can also see the real workings of karma with our speech. If you say something really negative to a person, you can watch instant karma, both in the person you're talking to and the person and yourself. And the opposite, by saying something nice, you can really affect changes in a positive way. Now, what does the sutras say about right speech? So, quote here, the Buddha says, he dwells refraining from false speech, a truth speaker, one to be relied on, trustworthy, dependable, not a deceiver of the world, abandoning malicious speech. He does not repeat there what he has heard here to the detriment of these, or repeat here what he's heard there to the detriment of those. Thus he is a reconciler, and those at variance, and an encourager of those at one, rejoicing in peace, loving it, delighting in it, one who speaks up for peace. Abandoning harsh speech, he refrains from it. He speaks whatever is blameless, pleasing to the ear, agreeable, reaching the heart, urbane, pleasing and attractive to the multitude. Abandoning idle chatter, he speaks at the right time, what is correct and to the point of Dhamma and discipline. He is a speaker whose words are to be treasured, seasonable, reasoned, well-defined, and connected with the goal. Now, this is the advice given to monks. I spent a long time looking what he said to lay people, and the only addition of what he said to lay people that I could find, he says, abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. When he has been called to a town meeting, a group meeting, a gathering of his relatives, his guild, or the royalty, example, the royal court proceeding, if he is asked as a witness, continue to tell me, good man, what you know. If he doesn't know, he says, I don't know. If he does know, he says, I know. If he hasn't seen, he says, I haven't seen. If he has seen, he says, I have seen. Thus he doesn't consciously tell a lie for his own sake, and for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. This is very similar to one of the Ten Commandments about bearing false witness. Now, the summary of Buddhist right speech is, when you speak, to notice what you're going to say. Is it truthful? Is it useful? Is it kind? And is it timely to say? So the outline for my talk, there are four types of speech I'll talk about, which is talked about in the sutras. Backbiting and gossip, lying, harsh, angry, or aggressive language, frivolous and useless speech. In addition, I'll also talk about being silent and listening, and finishing the talk with a discussion on wholesome and supportive speech. So backbiting or gossip. Much of the information on this part of the talk I've gotten from this book, which is called Words That Hurt, Words That Heal, How to Choose Words Wisely and Well by Rabbi Joseph Telushkin. I read this book around 5 years ago and gave it to Gil, and he was so impressed with it, he gave a whole talk on Monday night on it, and I encourage everybody to read this book. The first, what is gossip? And the definition is the dissemination of accurate information that will lower the status of the person to whom it refers to, or can be translated as negative truths. And I'm going to give an example of this by telling a joke. There was a rabbi, a priest, and a minister, and they're at a party, and they're drinking away, having a good time. And the minister says, you know, let's all tell each other our vices, and being members of the faith, we'll keep it confidential, and this will help us in our faith to be better as ministers and rabbis. So they all agree, and the rabbi goes first. The rabbi says, well, you know, when I was in the army, I accidentally had pork, and I really loved it. And so every 6 months, I really get the urge, and I go to a neighborhood outside my neighborhood, and I have a pork rib dinner, and I really love it. And the priest goes, I don't know how to keep this celibacy. I mean, it is impossible, and I'll be honest with you, I'm having affairs with several unmarried women outside my parish. And they all look at the minister, and the minister's quiet, and they tell the minister, come on, tell us, you know. And he says, no, I can't. He says, come on, we'll keep it confidential. He says, well, I'll tell you. I love to gossip, and I can't wait to get out of here and tell everybody what you just told me. So why do we gossip? There are many reasons. Some people do it to raise their status while lowering someone else's. We sometimes set up comparison in the mind that we are better than the person we are gossiping about. Some people do it because they are angry with a person, and they gossip about them. Some people derive great enjoyment from seeing people who are moral leaders be brought down to our level. This could be one reason the minister gossiped. I think it was more it's enjoyable. I think it's this last reason is some people gossip to show they are in the know, that they know something about somebody. When I was in college, I became friends with a person who later on went on to become the chief editor of the National Enquirer. And I was talking to him, and I was asking him how they got their stories, you know, like woman marries man from Mars and stories like that. And what was interesting was he told me about a lot of the stories about the stars, and most of those stories are told by their friends. Their friends will call in and tell them about that. And people who are know something about somebody like to tell that to people, and it makes them feel important. There was a study done on teenage boys and teenage girls. And they found teenage girls gossip a lot. And the study found out that one of the reasons teenage girls do is because it's a social status thing. If they know some private thing about somebody who's very popular, they know that person must be really close with them, and it increases their status. There is a great study that was done at Northeastern University on gossiping, and in that study, what the professors wanted to know was how fast the gossip would travel. So they put out this notice, and they put it all over the campus, announcing a wedding that everybody's invited to, and the wedding's going to take place on the steps of the student union. And so they put the flyers all over the campus, and the wedding was announced for June 6th, and they put the flyers out on June 7th. And then they went around to find out how many people heard of the wedding, and like 54% actually heard of the wedding. And it was even more surprising, 12% of the people actually claimed to have gone to the wedding. And they thought maybe, and actually they actually described about the wedding, the bride and the groom, the bride showing up in a beautiful wedding gown and the groom showing up tuxedo and going off in a limousine. They thought maybe, you know, there really was a wedding that day, and they checked into it and there wasn't. So some people will not only gossip, but they'll even change the truth. There's a real lure of listening and to telling gossip. The next time you want to gossip or hear gossip, watch how your mind works and how it reacts. I notice that mine is a real lure pushing to it. And this is normal, even with very advanced practitioners. Joseph Goldstein, in his new book, One Dharma, talks, when he's talking about the precepts, he talks about one time being interviewed for an article, and the person who was interviewing was really trying to lure him into gossip. And he says he can feel his mind trying to go that way, but he was able to be mindful and have a wholesome speech, and he felt very good about that. Not gossiping is very difficult, especially in our culture. Our media and newspapers are geared up for gossip. When you hear a juicy story on the television or in the headlines in the paper, do you skip over it or do you read it? Gossiping is also a social thing. We find it interesting when we get together with friends and family. It is something to talk about. Yet we all know the disastrous effects of it, and if we don't, I'm going to give you some examples. Sally Clowes, also a teacher at Spirit Rock, gave a talk here around three weeks ago. And she's talking about people doing various things in their practice, and one person was very committed to write speech, and the reason, and he says he practices it all the time, not that he has write speech, but the reason he's so intimately involved in it is one time he was gossiping about somebody, and that person happened to be in back of him and heard it. A disastrous effect of gossip is given in this book. When President Ford was president in Sacramento, there was an assassination attempt on his life, and there was a gentleman next to the woman who had the gun and diverted it. And the gentleman became a national hero overnight, so the media immediately wanted to know all about him. And they went and interviewed him, and he really didn't want to be interviewed. And finally he agreed, and he said, well, just talk about the incidents of saving the president's life. And so this piqued their curiosity. Why does he want to talk about himself? So they dug deeply, and they found out he was gay, and he was very involved in the gay movement in San Francisco. And then when the reporters went to his mother, who lived in Michigan, I think it was Michigan, and said, how do you feel about your son being involved in the gay movement? And actually, she didn't even know her son was gay. And after that, she didn't want to speak to her son. And when she died, his father said that your mother doesn't want you at the funeral. And this really broke his heart, and he ended up drinking himself to death. And in hindsight, the reporter said, well, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't have said that. And Rabbi Telushkin, in his seminars, asked, how many of you can think of at least one episode in your life that would cause you great embarrassment would have become known to everyone else here? This is invariable, many hands go up. And he's not talking about armed robbery, but minor things. A good general rule, if you feel the urge to gossip, is to remember the golden rule. Would you want somebody else talking about things which you wouldn't want to be known? Would you want someone gossiping some of your weaknesses to people? To quote the Swiss theologian Jonathan Levater, never tell evil of a man if you do not know it for certainty. And if you know it for certainty, then ask yourself, why should I tell it? There's some categories of gossiping. One of them is tattling. And again, there's an excellent example in this book of a friend of his who became engaged, and the woman's sister was speaking to their uncle, and her uncle happened to say, "Carol's a very sweet girl, but David is much more accomplished and worldly than she is. I'm afraid that he's going to be bored with her." And her sister actually told the woman who was engaged this remark. Before this remark, the woman was very close with her uncle, and her father died, and her uncle was going to walk her down the aisle. And the relationship now is almost non-existent. Now, the impression I got was that the uncle loved the niece very much. And the problem with tattling or gossip or anything is we always tell the negative things, and we don't see the whole story. For instance, we don't go around gossiping, "Hey, did you hear the news? Joe's really a good guy." There's some quotes in here by Mark Twain and Blaise Pascal on the subject. Blaise Pascal says, "I lay down as a fact that if all men knew what others say of them, there would be not four friends in the world." And Mark Twain says, "It takes your enemy and your friend working together to hurt you to the heart, the one to slander you and the other to get the news to you." Another category of gossiping is rumors, things you're not sure are true. The media is very good with this. And rumors are usually of a negative quality also. And when you hear a rumor about a person, you should be very careful about it to find out whether it's true or not. The last form of gossiping is slander. Slander is a form of gossiping, except in this case, it actually is untrue. And gossiping can cause a lot of divisiveness in a community, especially in a spiritual community. In many Orthodox Jewish communities, the practice of not gossiping is taken very seriously. There's a community center in New York where they have a poster on the wall and it says, "Don't gossip." And there's a picture of a man shoving another man down into a meat grinder. So you can see how seriously they take the practice. They even have non-gossip support groups. Also, there was a rabbi in the 1800s who wrote the definitive book on right speech. It's called Guard Your Tongue. His name is Hafetz Hyman. And what a lot of Orthodox people will do, they'll actually put a picture of him by their phone to remind them not to gossip when they're talking on the phone. But how are we as practitioners to be skillful in our speech about gossip? One is just being aware is a great start. The second is see the great harm that gossip causes. And as you practice these two over time, I think your amount of gossiping will go down. If you're angry with a person, don't go around telling other people what a rotten person they are. Be constructive. If you need to talk to other people, stay focused on the problem. Not making the other person agree with you that the one you're angry with is the devil incarnate. The best solution is if you can actually talk to the person you're mad with. Telushkin recommends, you know, not gossiping cold turkey, and if you have to gossip, find somebody you're close with, like a spouse or a friend, and do your gossiping there. I have the opposite opinion. I think you should find a friend or several friends who, when you get together, you make a vow. Vow is a strong word, but that you're not going to gossip. And that's the way I started practicing it. The center here is a good place. I think the gossip level is very low in the center. My grandmother was a great example of not gossiping. When people would be gossiping around her about somebody, she'd always say, "Can't you think of something nice to say about them?" The next topic is lying, and I'm going to assume that all of you aren't outright liars or pathogenic liars. Lying or false speech can include slight exaggerations and humorous untruths to falsehoods for self-protection, protection of others, or self-aggrandizement. Or they can be deliberate lies told with malicious intent. The effect of lying does two things. One, it ruins your credibility and trustworthiness, which will either take a long time to repair or it will never be repaired with certain people. The second is that lying can cause great disservice to others because it diminishes their ability to trust themselves. People think you're lying, but then they don't want to think it. A great example of a person who had trustworthiness, an interesting example, I don't know if you people have seen the movie Birdman of Alcatraz. It was with Burt Lancaster and Robert Mauldin. But Birdman of Alcatraz was Richard Stroud, who he was convicted of murder up in Alaska and went to a federal penitentiary at Leavenworth. And there, in a fit of rage, because the guard wouldn't let him see his mother, he killed the guard. And they put him in solitary confinement for the rest of his life. And while he was there, he became an expert on birds and on bird diseases. And he was a real genius. And then he went to study a bunch of other subjects, and he was transferred to Alcatraz and worked on prison reformation. And there was a riot at Alcatraz, and the prisoners took over the prison, and then guards came in and abated everything. And they weren't sure about one block, whether it was secure. And Richard Stroud, the warden, told people to throw out your weapons, and Richard Stroud got on the PA system and threw a gun out, and he says, that is all the guns in D block. And one of the guards asked the warden, how can you believe him? He's a con. He says, you know, this prison has been a real pain in my side for the last 30 years, but one thing he's never done to me, he's never lied. Many of us remember when we were teenagers how we'd exaggerate to appear in the know or to make us more important than we are. It's an example of also gossiping. The next topic is harsh, angry, or aggressive language. Most of us know how quickly we can get angry, and when we get angry at somebody, our words become harsher and harsher. It's sort of like we were getting into a physical fight where you use more and more violence, except your words become stronger and stronger, and you start to bring things in that have nothing to do with what you're angry about. How many times have we heard people say to us, I really didn't mean what I said to you, I was just very angry. But we all know that anger has lasting effects. The expression is sometimes used when people get really angry and when use a lot of verbosity when they're angry is that they use their tongues as a weapon. Many people say they can't hold their rage. There's an excellent example in this book of, he said, imagine yourself that you're really angry at, let's say, your spouse, and you're yelling and screaming, and all of a sudden your boss shows up at the door. And it's very important for you to be nice to your boss. You'll see how quickly your anger dissipates. A friend of mine who doesn't meditate, but he's seriously involved in personal growth, once told me the story. One time he was getting angry at his partner, and then he realized that he had a choice here. He didn't have to go into a rage with his language, and he can control his anger, that he had a choice here. And when he told me this story, I was really happy. I told him it took me many years of meditating to come to this point. So how do we mediate through this? Again, the golden rule is a good guide. We do not like when angry words are hurled at us, so why should we hurl them at other people? The second is our mindfulness practice. On the cushion, we're with ourselves, and we can feel the anger arise. Anger is a very complex process. It involves thoughts and bodily sensations and emotions. And as we develop our mindfulness, we can skillfully navigate through these feelings and emotions. Remember, it's not wise to bottle up your anger. You need to search for a middle way. Common wisely advice is always take a few deep breaths before you talk to somebody when they're angry. Become aware of what is making you angry, and again, stay focused on that. Don't add extra stuff. Well, your mother was a drunkard, that's why you were that way, or things of that nature. You can tell the person you're angry with that you're angry. You need a few minutes to calm down before you can speak. Or you may want to even wait a day or two. The next topic is frivolous and useless speech, or not talking. I got interested, really interested in this subject several years ago. Several years ago, my sister, who was in New York, said she wanted to come out here and sit a retreat. And what she was really fearful of was being silent. On retreats, you don't speak. And that she was really fearful of that, and she didn't think she can keep silent for 2 days. And as I started speaking to more and more people, I kept on hearing that also. And I know my mother would always say, my wife and I would go on retreats and goes, well, you don't talk to Cheryl while you're on retreats? I go, no. Or she'd go away on retreat for a month. I go, you're not going to talk to her for a month? And I remember there was a couple after one retreat, I was driving to the airport, and we're talking about it. And says, yeah, a lot of my friends say that also. And the woman said, I didn't have the heart to tell them that your mind is talking so much that you never feel alone. But what is this urge we have to speak? What is this uncomfortableness? There's a number of reasons for that. I'm thinking about it. I remember back to my first Zen retreat. And when I sat this retreat, I didn't know many people at the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And I slept in a room with six other people. There's six or eight other people, and I didn't know any of them. And before, at a lot of retreats, you get to meet your roommates and talk with them, but I didn't get a chance to do that. And so at the end of the night, I just went to the room, and I had to go to sleep with these six or eight strangers. And I felt really, really uncomfortable. I just really felt the urge to say goodnight to them, just to acknowledge them there. So that's one urge, one reason why we feel the urge to speak. And use frivolous speech is because we feel uncomfortable. Another reason is the mind could be restless. If you notice on the pillow when you get restlessness, try to notice those feelings when they come off the pillow and what you do about them. It's also wise to look at why you want to speak to people. What's your motivation? Are you interested in self-aggrandizement? Are you interested in speaking in order to know more what other people have to say? Are you interested in having your views accepted? Or are you truly interested in coming to consensus? Not that any of these reasons are wrong. There's no reason to do self-aggrandizement. We all do it from time to time. Another wise thing to look at is silence and listening, the power of silence. I know I was on a retreat last year, and one of the students asked the teacher about the silence, being silent, and which is more powerful, the silence of meditation. And he said that him and many teachers have gotten together, and they concluded that actually the silence was extremely powerful, that if you went for 10 days without speaking and didn't meditate, that it would be a very, very powerful experience. It is common over time, as we develop a mindfulness, we learn to listen to ourselves and also magically listen more fully to other people. There's a wise saying, I don't know who said it, but you have two ears and one mouth and you should use them in those proportions. There's great power in using words succinctly. Haridas Baba is a great Indian teacher who's actually one of Ram Dass's teachers. And he's taken a vow of silence. As a matter of fact, when Ram Dass studied with him in India in the 60s, he had a vow of silence. And the way he communicates was through a chalkboard, which he wears around his neck. And so he writes. And there are many people who do Indian practice who actually use that as a practice. They have a chalkboard. And so you have to become really succinct. And Haridas Baba is in Santa Cruz now, and I understand people who have met him. It's an awesome experience. There's also great healing in those who can truly listen. I never met the Dalai Lama or the Karmapa, but I understand people who have met the Dalai Lama or the Karmapa, even if you're in a big crowd, a lot of people have said, when they come up and talk to you, it's like you're the only person there. I'll give some other wholesome and supportive speech. This is also from Rabbi Talushin's book, but I've been talking about things you shouldn't do, but wise things to try to do is say thank you a lot. I love you. I finally have gotten to the point when my wife calls me at work, and at the end of the conversation, I will tell her I love her. Since I've seen some of my other colleagues do that, I feel okay doing that. Asking people how you are and what do you need, and most important, I'm sorry. And I give all these things, the things I say you shouldn't do and should do, is not as moral imperatives, but to try. Try it out. Try being silent. Try being talking a lot and see the effect on you. Sometimes people in spiritual groups become really silent and don't talk, and they go to extremes, and that advising that, but see what it feels like. I'll end my talk by giving a quote that Gil actually gave several weeks ago, which I found really profound. He said, people spend more time carefully choosing their clothes than they do their words. And so I hope I've conveyed to you the power of words and the power of not speaking. And I've been asked to announce there's an Inside Dialogue retreat here next week, September 27th and 28th. There's flyers out there for it. Starting at 7 to 9 on Friday and continues on Saturday, the 28th, 9 to 5. And a lot of this seems to be on speaking and listening and right speech. So that's my talk, and I'll open it up for if anybody has any questions. Well, we can sit here in silence. Huh? There's plenty of gray areas, and one thing I realized in the talk, I wrote it down here, but I didn't emphasize it. One of the most important things in speaking is to look at your intention when you speak. Like if you're being critical of somebody, and how to be critical. I mean, it's important if you're going to criticize somebody not to do it in public. To call them aside so you don't humiliate them. But there are plenty of gray areas. And like I said, also, it's so... in our culture, to gossip, we don't even think twice about it, that people have a hard time when they get together knowing what to say if you don't gossip. So it is a very difficult. And even... the rabbis talk about that, how difficult of a practice it is to keep. With community of monks, it's you have a lot more self-support. There's a lot more guidelines, which are 238 precepts to keep. Being lay people, it makes it harder. But it's truly marvelous to meet people who who do practice this. And I says my grandmother was a remarkable woman. She lived 102. It was remarkable to see that, how she wouldn't gossip about people.
There's also the question, not so much of content of speech, but how one interacts with others. So, for example, you can hurt somebody by showing signs of impatience, mm-hmm. or being a little bit sharp in a reply, or not hearing the person out, or, in effect, implying criticism by finishing somebody's sentence, you know, get on with it, or say, oh, you know, it doesn't really make sense. So I think there's something, you may not say anything directly hurtful, but the attitude and the posture.
Right. And he talks about that in there, like if someone goes, you know, Bill, and you roll your eyes. It's not only verbal, but any gestures like that can be really hurtful to people.
This is where kindness and mindfulness come in.
Exactly.
I think that's one of the hardest things for myself to do anyway, is to back that up a few frames and find out. And ask myself the question, why have I postured that attitude? Why is it necessary to have that reaction?
Right.
And ask myself, and even more mindful is being gentle in the approach on myself for having done it and having to back up out of it or apologize for it more directly.
You know, for a long time, I'd see myself as going to gossip and even say, well, I really shouldn't say this. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, with this other gentleman's got me to clean up my foul language at work. People know that his office and my office are no gossip zones. That we don't gossip in there.
It's interesting. I posted a post-it note once, no gossip, free gossip zone. You know, gossip zone, free area or something like that on my door. And I found that it was difficult for me to not gossip. That seemed to be okay in my certain little area. But other people coming in and having conversation, you know, with each other and gossiping and being, you know, the encouragement of hearing about your grandmother is intervening and say this is a gossip-free zone, or looking at it and continuing to gossip, you know, to own my own space and ask that of other people when they are there. And one other notice on the I love you, you know, thing is that my daughter taught me something that she had started with her fiance, which is long distance. And they ask each other, have I told, and every day they say, and this has been going on for 2-3 years, you know, have I told you how much I love you today? And the answer, you know, the reply is to be no. You know, you have not. And then use an example, I love you as many threads as there are in a carpet in the entire world. And then they say, wow, that's plenty much. That's a lot, thank you. You know, and the other one in turn, then, not a day goes by that I don't do that same thing with her, and how easy it is to find out how boundless your love can be, for example. That's amazing.
There's a story in here where a gentleman's wife died, and they're at the cemetery, and the rabbi said, well, it's time to go home. And he goes, but I love my wife. And I says, I know. He says, but it's time to go home. He says, but I love my wife. He says, but, you know, we really need to go home now. He says, but you don't understand. I really love my wife. And one time I almost told her. And I told that to my colleague at work, and he said, you know, he's read articles that since September 11th, people are really involved with that. People are seeing the importance of their relationships and are doing those things more. There's also one more thing I want to say in this book. He had a movement which was actually supported by Senator Lieberman and another senator in here to have a Speak No Evil Day. And it hasn't passed the Senate, but the bill was the bill was there. Thank you for your remarks. It was really, really nice. Anybody else have any comments or questions or?
I have to say, I wonder if it's right to. I know you said that you know you have to gossip, and I think we all sometimes we do have to, or we get to moments where we feel like we have to do it in private. And I found that even that's not a good idea because it just reinforces your sense that you're right and they're wrong. And it, like, propagates this attachment of, like, having a higher ground in terms of character or whatever the issue is. And it seems like, you know, I mean, I have a probably similar work situation where there's a lot of gossip, and it's hard to avoid if it comes your way. But I found that, like, people, even if you're thinking it, you're too attached to the idea that you're right.
Well, he's recommending people can't quit cold turkey. Matter of fact, the book starts out saying that he asked people in his seminars how many people can go 24 hours without gossiping, and no one raises their hand. And he says, you know, if you ask that to somebody who drank or somebody who smoked, I mean, they have a real problem, and people don't see it as a real problem. So you know, one approach is cold turkey, and it gives wise and skillful advice if you are going to gossip with your wife and how to do it. Like I said, my approach was the opposite. I just went on regulating with certain people. I definitely wouldn't gossip. Then it got more and more. So we're supposed to meditate till 9 o'clock, and what a lot of people do in this meditation is lead a loving-kindness meditation. So I will lead you people in a loving-kindness meditation. So everybody can sit comfortably. Close your eyes. Take a couple of deep breaths. And you want to concentrate about your heart center. And there are classical phrases. You can make up your own phrases for loving kindness. And loving kindness always starts with yourself. And a lot of people have problems with that. The Buddha said, you can search all the world and you will not find one more deserving of love than yourself. But if you have hard time with this, I'll give some suggestions. And if that doesn't work, just you know, be gentle on yourself. But think of a person that you really love and feel joy, and think of the feelings of being around them. Or another suggestion: think of a time when you're very happy. And elicit those feelings. May I be happy. May I be safe and protected. May I be healthy and joy, healthy and strong. May I be at ease. May I be peaceful. Let this happiness spread to everyone in this room as we want to be happy. We want everyone in this room who's practicing hard and has various trials and tribulations, may they be at ease. May they be calm and peaceful. and radiating that kindness and happiness and joy outwards to the community around here, to the people in the apartment buildings around here, to all the people of Redwood City and the Bay Area. And radiating outwards through our country, over the entire world. And not only may all humans be happy and peaceful, but all beings that can be seen and not seen, may they be happy, may they be contented, may they feel safe and peaceful. Whatever merit we've accumulated from our practice here today, maybe it shared with all living beings. And from my talk, whatever you found useful, take with you. Whatever you haven't found useful, please discard.